Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 10th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning, we are presenting Esther Men, a talk entitled Singing God's Praises, Psalms, and the Church's Song, Psalm 90. Let's listen in.
And for the book Practicing Our Faith, they have a chapter on singing in the church. It's one of the essential practices of a church. It's very worthwhile reading. And also, I just want to point out that there's, in the bookstore, there's both a paperback and hardback new translation of the Psalter in, it's called A Faithful and Inclusive Rendering. So it's a new translation and an attempt to be inclusive as far as gender and so forth. And there's also some hymnals, speaking of singing. Mark Douglas usually pushes these, but since he's not here, this is Songs of Zion and Lead Me, Guide Me. And today we're not going to be singing anything from them, but they're there for you. So we'll get started now, officially. My name's Esther Men, and this is the second of a series on the Psalms and the Church's Song, where each day we'll be looking at a different psalm that I've selected that has been drawn into the church's hymnody. So we'll be singing one or more songs at the end, hymns at the end of each session. And yesterday we looked at Psalm 23, a psalm of confidence, with that imagery of the shepherd and the host. And today we're going to take a different type of a psalm. We're going to look at Psalm 90. So, we'll start by reading that. But before we do read that, I just want to say that one of the points that Practicing Our Faith makes in that book on singing is that there's so few places left in our society today where we sing together. People know Happy Birthday, maybe the national anthem, that's about it. And it's really in the churches and synagogues that we still have this practice of singing. And if, through our words and through the music, we remember our past, our stories, we remember our story, and we're formed by that singing. So it's a precious practice. It's especially appropriate, I felt, to look at some examples from the Psalms, because the Book of Psalms or the Psalter is itself a hymn book. You could call it Israel's hymn book, the hymn book of the Second Temple. And it contains 150 hymns, prayers, laments, different liturgical pieces. And today we're going to look at the example of a community lament together. So this hymn book then becomes an important source for the church's hymnody. Psalms are used in other ways too. Of course, they're recited during worship services in many denominations, and in monastic contexts, they were repeated over the course of a week, so it really became central to those communities. But let's begin today by looking at Psalm 90. Interestingly enough, it's at the beginning of the fourth book within the Psalms. There's five different subdivisions within the Psalms. Kind of interesting. I think it was divided that way as a kind of parallel to the Pentateuch or the Torah, the first five books of Moses. And also, these divisions show a kind of growth of the Psalter that is more and more were tacked on as they were composed and collected. Just as a little trivia item, for example, if you look at Psalm 72 at the very end. This is at the end of what's known as the second book, and you have a nice little closure here, a benediction at the end of 18. Blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who alone does wondrous things. Blessed be his glorious name forever. May his glory fill the whole earth. Amen and amen. The prayers of David, the son of Jesse, are ended. So at some time, this was the end of the prayers of Jesse. But there are more psalms later that are attributed to David. So you can see there's a kind of a growth, just as we revise hymnals and include older material, and this is the same kind of process that's happening. So you can really see that it is a kind of a hymn book. Okay, so today we're going to look at a psalm that's credited to Moses, and the one at some period in its history. So what I suggest is, why don't we read this, even verse by verse. We could just go around. If you'd like to start, we could just read across the front and then come back and go all the way around. So would you like to start?
Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you brought forth the earth and the world from everlasting to everlasting, you are God.
You turn us back to dust and say, turn back, you mortals.
For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it is past, or like a watch in the night.
You sweep them away. They are like a dream, like grass that is renewed in the morning.
Would you like to take continue?
In the morning it flourishes and is renewed. In the evening it fades and withers.
For we are consumed by your anger, by your wrath we are overwhelmed.
You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance.
For all our days pass away under your wrath, our years come to an end like a sigh.
The days of our life are 70 years, or perhaps 80, we are strong. Even then their span is only toil and trouble. They are soon gone, and we fly away.
Who considers the power of your anger? Your wrath is as great as the fear that is due you.
So teach us to count our days, that we may gain a wise heart.
Turn, O Lord, how long? Have compassion on your servants.
Satisfy us in the morning with your unfailing love, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days.
Make us glad as many days as you have afflicted us, and as many years as we have seen you work.
Let your work be manifest to your servants, and your glorious power to their children.
Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and prosper for us the work of our hands. Oh, prosper the work of our hands.
Great. Thank you. So if you were here last time, you'll notice the contrast in mood and in content, too. How would you characterize this psalm? If you had to summarize the central message or mood or type, we called the Psalm 23 a psalm of confidence.
Well, the first half, or I should say half, but up to verse 5, or I guess even up to, yeah, to verse 5, even into 6, it's just like, oh, you're such a wonderful God, and the second half is like, and boy, are we in trouble. I know, it's just like all these wonderful things about this, and it almost sounds like a loving and wonderful creating God, and then we are consumed by your anger. Whoa. Mm-hmm.
Okay. It's quite reflective of not only ourselves, but who God is.
It's quite reflective, mm-hmm, about who God is and who we are.
Yes.
And you're saying the same thing. You're saying that you see different parts, mm-hmm, that emphasize those different aspects. Mm-hmm. Now, would you, here's a suggestion. Let's see what you think about this. I would say that the first two verses emphasize more God's identity as our dwelling place and God's eternity. And then it seems that with 3, we turn our attention to humanity. And there's a contrast there. Mm-hmm. And there's that reflection through contrast, almost, that eternity and then the temporality, really transient, I guess. Do you see other parts? Where would you say, if we did it that way, you may want to challenge that construction or affirm it, but if we said the first two were kind of an opening statement, confidence of faith, you know, sort of summing up what God is and God's endurance. And if we said that the second part had to do with mortals and how fleeting our life is, how far would that go? That section go?
Oh, through 10, it looks like, maybe 12.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it's more of a supplication.
Okay, good. So you have a petition at the end. Mm-hmm. Excellent. A petition at the end in light of these reflections about God's endurance and human temporality. And I like how you equivocated a little bit about where that starts. Why did you kind of waffle there?
Well, I guess partly because in this version, it's broken up that way. I mean, there's a space between verses 10 and 11,
mm-hmm.
whereas there isn't between 11 and 12.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess when you look at the content of what's there, it almost seems like the break should be between 11 and 12.
Okay, excellent. Okay, can you tell us why you thought that?
Since 11 still talks about who considers the power of your anger, your
mm-hmm.
wrath is great, and then right away in 12, so teach us to count our days. We may gain a
wise heart. There you go. So you have the first imperative, the first request here for wisdom. Now, that's a very good point there. I would probably put it at 12 too, except then there's an interesting marker. The same word occurs in 3 and 13. It's kind of a thematic word.
Turn.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's one reason. Yes. Mm-hmm.
There's a really wonderful musical setting of this old song by Charles Ives. His transitions occur at those two places.
At
3 and 13.
3 and 13. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's good reason for that. 12 anticipates the kind of petition, but I think that there's that strong marker of turn. In the first, it's you turn, or actually it's the word is shuv, the root is shuv, which means return. So we are dust, and then we are returning to dust. If you translate it as return, it's even stronger, because all we are is dust, right? So you turn us back to dust. I guess turn us back is translated as return, as turn. Excuse me, he's translating shuv as turn us back, so turn back, those two words. So this is what God does to us, and it accentuates sort of the difference between God and us. And then the psalmist requests that God return. Turn, O Lord, how long? God's turning is to remembering us. And this wonderful list of things. Have compassion, satisfy us, make us glad, and rejoice. They're very positive, really, in light of the kind of reflections earlier in the kind of lament or complaint section, where everything's so transient and the experience of wrath and anger. But here is their request for joy, not just, you know, for endurance or courage or anything like that, for gladness. So, yeah, I think that those would be the three major portions there. Do you sense a dominant mood? You said it was reflective.
Mm-hmm.
Other people have adjectives that would describe the mood or moods of the song.
Seems to be almost passive.
Hmm.
Not quite as some of the passive verses in the 23rd Psalm, where all these things are done to us. But still, you turn us back. We are consumed by your anger. Just the tense of it seems rather passive.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting, because, yeah, mm-hmm. Did you?
I just think lamenting and beseeching, sort of.
Lamenting and beseeching, mm-hmm. We had, earlier in the first discussion, someone said that they detected anger. At God, actually. Does anybody detect that, or is there more of a resignation?
I almost think more anger at themselves, I mean, sort of a sense of chagrin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've done these things, and so we deserve this. We deserve to be swept away and consumed. And, you know, almost like it's part of the supplication, they have to first, the psalmist has first debase himself in order to then feel worthy to make the supplication or make the petition.
Mm-hmm.
But anger towards God. Hmm.
There does seem to be a kind of deference, that is, the invocation seems to try to remove any sense that they're being they're blaming God for this. They seem, in other words, I've seen angrier psalms.
Right, right.
This seems to be, you want to set this in the framework in the first two verses of knowing that God's their dwelling place, and then God returns us to dust, but in a sense, you know, God's angry for good reason, and there it is.
Mm-hmm. So it sort of justifies
right.
This experience that we have.
Right.
Things aren't right, things are passing, and so forth, by saying, well, we're sinful, and this is God's anger. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, in this musical setting of it that I'm reminded of, it's got an organ accompaniment. The very first thing you hear is a low C pedal in the organ. The foot never lifts off that C for the entire work, which lasts, 7 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
That one, the left foot is jammed down in that C pedal constantly. And then what Charles Ives, who's a pretty good composer, expresses the various moods of what's happening above it with harmonic changes, for instance, in the right hand. So it starts out, verses 1 and 2 are very C major, and the whole last part, 14 through 17, is all very nice C major. And in the middle, there's one point where he's on the word wrath, a number 9, he's got a whole tone cluster that covers all, I think, 32 voices. It covers the whole thing. It's just an amazing chord. Then it comes back to our year is going to come to an end like a sigh. Well, there it's in the King James, so it says, as a tale that is told, and they're all back in unison there. But all that stuff is happening in the meantime, but that C pedal never quits.
Mm-hmm.
See, there's never any doubt that God is in charge of all of this. There's a foundation that constantly works throughout it. And so both the anger and the despair, as well as the hope, are not as important as the fact that there's that foundation which never, ever leaves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a good piece, and I think that it captures the spirit of the text in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that really, I think that he is onto something here, because it starts out with this invocation of the Lord who's been the dwelling place for whatever else is being discussed here, or coming and going, or going back to dust, or flying away, or being swept away, all this. So, and look at all of these references to time here, a dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were brought forth. When we look up these mountains, even before that, or before he would ever form the earth and the world. So even going back before the creation of the world, from everlasting to everlasting, not just from everlasting, but from everlasting to everlasting. These are sort of the largest imaginable reaches of time, your God. So that sea or whatever there, that's like, okay, there's persistence in whatever else. And then it's wonderful, in the face of that, you have all these images of transience that follow as a kind of contrast. You notice, what are some of the most striking to you there?
Well,
I'm sorry, grass,
grass.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Dream.
Dream, a dream, right.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday when it's past. You know, yesterday when it's past. It's not just a day. It's not just the contrast between 1,000 years and a day, but it's yesterday when it's past. I mean, how much can you even remember of yesterday? That almost has that kind of dreamlike quality.
And by the time we get to the end, we're ready to say it's 70 or 80 years or not, or nothing.
Right, that's right. That's a long life.
That's a long life.
Uh-huh. That's right, it builds us up to that.
Mm-hmm.
So we get to 70 or 80 years and we say, wow, that's nothing. And even that's the max, and even that, their toil and trouble is their the quality of them. Soon gone, we fly away.
I didn't see a feeling of anger so much here as I did just reality.
Reality. Mm-hmm.
And first of all, that I realize that God is my dwelling place. Mm-hmm. I realize how short life is like. But then look at all the other wonderful things. The satisfaction, the gladness that you give me, the favor that I experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, mm-hmm. Really good. Anger,
well, it
appear to be here.
This is good. This is a very different reading of the psalm.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you're right, it does have a very reflective mood to it.
Mm-hmm.
The book of Job comes very much to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Doubting the sense that God is the all-powerful, and man comes to the realization that he is a child of God, and God is in control. I keep thinking of the book of Job the whole time I read this.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for bringing that up. Some of us might think that Job is in the middle, a little feistier than
yes.
this person. But there's certainly some of the reflections on
the human insignificance
frailty
of man
too, mm-hmm.
the relationship to God.
Mm-hmm. Very good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was going to say that in the last part of it, in light of the first two sections, the last section really shows a lot of faith that in spite of, you know, all of that from verse 3 to 12, you know, we're really horrible people, but we can still ask you, you know, for all of these wonderful things, and it's like a sense of grace, you know, that we know that we make you angry, and yet we can come to you and ask you for love in the morning and rejoicing in all of our days and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Grace.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like it was written by Job after he'd been through the whole experience and chastened by it. I mean, in other words, the invocation echoes what God tells Job. I mean, here this person says, before the mountains were brought forth, and it's, I think, in Job, God who says, where were you when I, tamed Leviathan and formed the mountains and so forth, and it's as though here's some person who's learned all those hard lessons,
mm-hmm.
who is now a little more reflective
mm-hmm.
and contemplative.
That's a good point,
mm-hmm.
because that's exactly God's response to Job in the world.
Yeah.
To
yeah.
say,
yeah.
You weren't there, and you're just,
yeah.
you have no perspective.
Yeah.
Well, this tries to give us a perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
Teach us to count our days
mm-hmm.
so that we may gain a wise heart. Teach us to use the little time that we have. Yeah, right.
Right. Well, that's the verse I wanted to call attention to, verse 12. Is there any sense, perhaps, that that's a turning point before we actually get to the turning that
mm-hmm.
we're going to ask God to do? Any sense that what's gone in the verses before have been a proper counting of our days? And that we have gained wisdom simply by this act, this reflective process that we've done in verses 3 to 12, by
mm-hmm.
taking a truthful, realistic look at our situation before God and time, that now we are wiser than we were before we prayed the psalm, and we're ready to say the next prayer, which is, turn, O Lord. How long? Have compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've prepared ourselves spiritually by this counting that we just did,
mm-hmm.
now to pray more boldly.
Mm-hmm. I like that very much, because it is all about counting the days and
mm-hmm.
and reflecting what they're like up to that point.
Well, be mindful of each day as it bears a gift to you.
Well, in fact, what would be the Hebrew there in, for the that is translated here, so?
Well, I can
so teach us. I mean, it could mean something like
in this therefore
in this way teach us.
Oh, uh-huh.
In the way that we've just been speaking, teach us.
But let me I see because so means either therefore or thus.
Yes. Uh-huh.
In other words, this is the way to do it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, let me do a little quick check here.
I think 15 is kind of funny to me, because at least give us the 50-50 chance to have a good time.
Oh, yeah. Okay, we acknowledge that we're going to have bad times.
He doesn't have the psalmist doesn't ask to be freed from all this.
No.
He acknowledges this is the way it is, but at least let us be happy half the time.
Half the time. Is the glass half full or half empty? Yes, let it be half full and half empty, right? Oh, that's good. I like that, too. So there really is a lot of recognition that life isn't always that fun or that joyous. Mm-hmm. And look, I like what I like about this also is look how long the section 3 to 12 is in comparison to the statement of faith and the petition, which implies God's ability to make us glad and so forth. Those kind of statements of confidence, the lament or the complaint is the longest part. So I think it maybe echoes some human experience. Mm-hmm. We may even feel those times of discouragement and transience more, even if they're shorter, we may dwell on them more or feel them more deeply. There's happy times may go quickly. And I'm still looking, I'm sorry. I have to stop talking for a minute.
Well, maybe we almost have to force ourselves to look at reality, which certainly, I don't know about that Hebrew culture, but in our culture, there are a lot of people around who are trying to say, you can be immortal almost. I mean, you can get to keep yourself in shape and, why worry? Take Prozac or whatever it is, So just the idea of that it's hard to do those things that we're doing in verses 3 to 12.
Mm-hmm.
It takes time and effort to do mm-hmm. them.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to report here in verse 12. It says, "Limnot yamenu kein hoda." It says, "To number our days, thus teach us." So that would be the best. Thus, so this is actually a description. What's gone before can be seen as kind of a description of how we should learn. Or we're asking for instruction in recognizing that we have very short time on this earth.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So thank you very much for pointing that out. That would perhaps be the reason why you really would want to start. It has a transitional kind of quality to the next part because you do have the imperative, but it seems to sum up that whole passage then that describes and laments and complains and compares and contrasts God's eternity and our frailty. What do you think about this reference to God's anger and wrath? And our sinfulness. How does that strike people? It's going to be interesting. I'm going to ask you to look at that in the look for that in the hymns.
I've been struggling with those verses in the 7 and 8, which give a theological reason for why we are like dust, or like grass, and they don't seem to necessarily fit that well to me. I mean,
they seem to fit the poem or your
the
experience.
Poem. They fit my experience. Oh. They just don't.
Okay.
They don't fit as well. Because I guess because of like the woman in the front row, I think this is almost a description of reality.
Mm-hmm.
And that the theological book would be strong enough without attributing it to this. But maybe that's out of keeping with keeping it.
Well, it's kind of interesting because both 7 and 8, and then again in 11, it seems that it's a motif that's repeated and emphasized through that repetition. And then in 15 again, even in the midst of this prayer for renewal. Make us glad as many days as you've afflicted us. So then it comes up there too, this motif of.
Also in verse 11, your wrath is as great as the fear that is due you.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like.
So it's a repeated motif. And I guess that's interesting, it imparts a sort of moral evaluation on the whole thing, whereas otherwise it would be a reflection on time and so forth.
Well, it seems that, I think in part the reason that is there is that the two motifs of that central section seem to me to be, on the one hand, transience, which we've been talking about, but on the other hand, toil. And the fact that you sense in the background that things just haven't been going well with the crops and so on, because the span is only toil and trouble. And the end, you get this double phrase of prospering work. Yes. And so lurking in the background is not just that people's lives are short, but that they're pretty miserable because, and here you hear the echoes of the curse in Genesis, cursing the ground and the sweat of your brow and so forth and so on. It just seems like there's something in the background about how their work just hasn't been going well, and they've been toiling endlessly and producing little, and so that God's wrath is not only behind their shortness of life, but also its toilsome quality. So they want not only half joy, but they want their work to prosper.
Mm-hmm. That's a good recognition. Because even at the very beginning, as you noted, you turn us back to dust, recalling the story in the third chapter of Genesis, the introduction of death, and also the quality of life, which is just labor intensive, constant work. So I think you're right. It seems almost to be a meditation on that chapter in Genesis to some extent.
Exactly. Which, of course, then gives a little bit more of a theological warrant there when you have so much wrath, because it's so tied closely to what brought on this whole situation of mortality and toil.
So the motif of disobedience is implied, even though we don't have the whole story of Genesis 3 and the tree and the fruit and so forth, but it seems to be behind this description here.
Yeah, 8 is about the closest you get to that.
You are set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance.
The whole business of their fall, their disobedience and sinfulness and iniquities.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, it's secret sins. It's not blatant sins. It's not, the psalmist isn't asking for forgiveness for any specific misdeed. You know, as you have, if you look at Psalm 51, it's a person with a very guilty conscience. And seeming to refer to a specific deed or deeds, but here.
This also brings up the question to me, though, that all the things that we call bad that happened to us, are they all a result of God's wrath? I do not believe that. I think
Yeah, please develop that.
Well, I just, things that have happened to me that have been very sorrowful to go ahead. It wasn't really God that brought them on, it was maybe sinfulness of man that happened to brought them. But I believe that God grieved with me just as much as I was grieving at the time. And I don't believe it was punishment for anything or his wrath being cast down upon me.
Yeah, thank you for that perspective. And actually, although you do see suffering depicted as punishment often in the Hebrew Bible, you have this great protest book of Job, right, where you have a righteous person experiencing suffering, where in the New Testament, you know, you have the life of Jesus giving evidence to that same claim that you're making, that not all suffering is due to sin or something that the person's...
As we've been going through here, I've been kind of reading along with the LBW version of Psalm 2, and I'm really intrigued with a difference in a pronoun in verse 5. In the RSV, it says, "You sweep them away, they are like a dream." And I think that the reference to them probably is 1,000 years in verse 4.
I'm sorry. Could you say that again?
Verse 5.
Sweep them away. Uh-huh.
You sweep them away. And I think mm-hmm. the reference to them is the 1,000 years in verse
mm-hmm.
4.
Mm-hmm.
And so that gives you a sense of that what God is sweeping away years and sweeping away time, and time is transient. Whereas in the LBW, in verse 5, it's you sweep us away mm-hmm. like a dream. Mm-hmm. We fade away suddenly like the grass. In the Hebrew, is that reference to time or to
okay.
people?
Let's see here. So I guess the question let me just look first, okay. and then I'll.
Because it makes a difference in that if it's time that's being referred to in verse 5, then really the only section in which the psalmist talks about anger towards people is really 7 and 8, because the rest of it is so much about time and transience and
mm-hmm.
sort of the way things are.
Yeah, and all those time words too, days, years, things like that, watches in the night being 4 hours. Okay, let's see here. Zimartam Shena. So it says it says them. It says you sweep them away,
mm-hmm.
not you. But there's also a note here, if you don't mind me looking real quick here. Well, I think that's an interpretation. It seems to be an interpretive translation. What you have to stress that it's the mortals you sweep mm-hmm. us away, or mm-hmm. is that?
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's pretty much what it says. Yeah, uh-huh. You sweep us away like a dream.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see here. You sweep them away; they are like a dream. Okay, well, see, it could refer back to the mortals because you turn us back to dust and say, "Turn back, you mortals."
Mm-hmm.
So you have the plural mortals there.
It could be,
mm-hmm.
but then why? I guess the rest of it, when it's referring to people, it's always us mm-hmm. in the rest of the psalm, and it's just that one verse that speaks of people in the third person. If it's referring to people,
mm-hmm.
I think that's what we had the intrigue in the first place. Is why suddenly this change in pronoun there?
Mm-hmm.
That's just in that verse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The them could actually refer to either. It's unclear, right? The years or the mortals. There's no specification, but I guess what the translation there, the paraphrase there, is doing is saying that refers to the mortals. Yeah, but it's not really clear in the Hebrew. It could be either. The 1,000 years, that would be the closest
mm-hmm.
antecedent, but yet you have the mortals there and. Mm-hmm. Isaiah 40, there's a comparison of people to grass. If you want to look at Isaiah 40, 6 to 8, brings up shades of Walt Whitman, doesn't it? But he was a bit more positive about the whole image, right? Isaiah 40, 6 to 8. Does anybody read that? Want to read that 6 to 8?
A voice says, "Cry out," and I said, "What shall I cry? All people are grass. Their constancy is like the flower of the field. The grass withers and the flower fades, but the breath of the Lord when the breath of the Lord blows upon it, surely the people are grass."
Truly the people are grass.
Her translation also says men instead of them, sweeping men away.
Uh-huh. Now, what translation do you have?
International.
New International.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. So we have an attempt. You know, the problem in translation is you want to be accurate to the original text, but you want to make sense. And so sometimes an interpreter will make it his or her primary duty to represent the text, and then you have kind of a wooden translation. Sometimes they'll take on the task of presenting a sense, and sometimes it's an interpreted sense. So mm-hmm. you have that, yeah, range.
A thing that strikes me in this is that the people are not. There's no sense in which the people are told to spend their lives differently than they have been spending them. The whole context is that that's the way life is. I'm reminded of several books that I've read that are not necessarily biblical, but they're influenced by biblical teachings. I think of one, the name of it is Kristin Lauren's daughter, or Sigurd Undset, when at the beginning, when she's born, she is presented with a wreath, which is a symbol for taking on the toils and pains and joys of life, having children, running a life, running a household, doing all this stuff. And it's symbolized by a ring on her finger as well. At the end, when she dies, they take off the ring off of her finger, and underneath is a white band that never got tanned. And on that band is a symbol for Mary in this particular case. There's an M, but the author interprets this as that always in her whole life, everything that she did was under the kingship of God. That the whole life, the ups and downs, the trials and tribulations, the joys and sorrows, everything finally was part of a great thing. It's like the low C in the eye of setting of this piece, that it was always there. And there's no sense in which this character is being criticized or judged for not having lived a different life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The book just says that's the way life is. And you leave that book profoundly moved, and yet you don't think, oh, if only she'd done it differently. Mm-hmm. And I don't think you read Psalm 90 as saying, oh, these people, if only they'd done it differently. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Which brings up one final thing I'd like to do before we sing the two hymns, and that's to reflect on what this superscription or this title, A Prayer of Moses, the Man of God, might mean. Mm-hmm. Now, many of the Psalms have these attributions. Well, there's like 73 attributed to David, and 12 to the sons of Korah, 12 to Asaph, and 2 to Solomon, 1 to Moses. Some other ones as well. Now, it's interesting that these are sort of our first examples of one of the first examples of biblical interpretation. It's setting these psalms in the context of other narratives that we have or other characters. And the process is later than the psalms themselves. You can tell because in the Septuagint or in the Greek translation of the Hebrew, there's actually more psalms that are attributed to David than there are in the Hebrew. So the process continued. And it sort of set up a narrative context saying, well, this corresponds to what we know about the life of Moses, for example. So it gives you a narrative context for that. There's also verbal reasons for connecting this with Moses. And just point that out first. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. That's the first line here. Now Moses, at the end of Deuteronomy, he's been giving kind of a summary, a retelling of all the story, beginning with the Exodus and the wilderness, and so forth. And at the very end of Deuteronomy, he presents a poem, kind of summing everything up. And this alternation between sort of narrative or prose and song is very common in the Bible. So he gives kind of a summation. If you look at Deuteronomy 33:27, we'll find some very similar words, except probably not, if you have the New Revised Standard Version, this is a little bit of a problem this morning because the translator did a very different translation. So, but there is a note there. 33:27, 26 starts, there's none like God, O Yeshurun, a poetic name for Israel, who rides to the heavens to your help, majestic through the skies. Now, the translation I have here is, he subdues the ancient gods, shatters the forces of old, he drove out the enemy before you, and said, destroy. Well, if you look at that first line, he subdues the ancient gods, if you have the New Revised Standard Version, or I should ask, who has a different translation there? Anybody?
Verse 27?
Yes.
33:27 is the the eternal God is your refuge.
Is your dwelling place, yeah.
And underneath are the everlasting arms.
Excellent. Okay, very good. So here we have a verse in the Bible that I was directing people to this morning, and we couldn't find that's exactly. Would you read that again?
The eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And even in the New Revised Standard Version, if you look, he subdues the ancient gods, there's a R, and you say, or the eternal God is a dwelling place, ma'on, it's a dwelling place. So it's really the same term, ma'on. And so there's a correspondence in language too here, the eternal God, so this reference to time and this reference to the image of the dwelling place are found both in Moses' speech in this possible translation and in Psalm 91.
Yeah, and Moses' speech speaks of and two generations.
Two generations, that's
and
right.
And we call to mind that we are of those generations, mm-hmm. and so on. Mm-hmm. So that would be another time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very good correspondence. And when you think about this life, think of Moses, who's elevated as the prophet par excellence, you know, the one who spoke with God face to face and brought the people out of Egypt and everything. He never completed what he set out to do, actually, right? To lead the people into the promised land. He only looked in. So here's a person whose work, he began this work, and yet he died. It said that he was 127 when he died, but still he never completed that work. It fell upon later generations to complete that. So there's a certain kind of resonance there. But there was no, well, he had some minor faults, like he struck the rock and so forth. But, he's not seen as a sinful person at all. He's the best, really. You know, he's a sort of an exemplar. And yet he, too, was hit with sort of the limits of human life and never entered into the promised land himself. So by putting that into that context of Moses' life, it has a certain resonance as well. Any final reflections about this or anything else before we turn to the hymns? Well, let's look first at a hymn that I got from a Presbyterian hymn. And I think you probably have to share. Well, did you have enough for this? Wonderful. Look for the language of the psalm and also maybe how it's been changed.
Ready? Mm-hmm. I'll play through once.
Yeah, that would be good.
I don't know this, I'm sure you don't. Thank you.
other reactions?
Made yours too pious there at the end.
What's that?
Made too pious there at the end.
Too pious at the end. Okay.
I mean, let us do better, God. You know, I mean, it's the end in the where's the cross for the work of our hands?
Of our hands.
It asks that we, I guess, establish Lord the work we do, but make your glory known, praise come to you.
It's a redefinition of the work that we do, right?
Yeah.
In terms that would be very familiar or resonate with Christian mission or community and so forth, right?
Yes.
And unto all your love we show. So it defines the type of work we do, I guess, is really the project of that. But you think it makes the poem lose its thing for you.
Well, it doesn't have satisfy us, make us glad.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems a little too pious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, he gets the 80 and in good health we will live, you know, mm-hmm. 80. Mm-hmm. But you're right, then all of a sudden whatever was I thought was really I seemed so true to the translation at first.
And yes.
Then it kind of left it.
Yes.
Yeah,
I think that's right. I mean, the versification even is interesting in 4, picks up that very ambiguity we talked about, because 4 contains both that verse 12, teach us to count our days, and verse 13, mm-hmm. which we took as the marker of return. So,
mm-hmm.
it's remarkably accurate up until 5.
Mm-hmm.
And even mostly cast in a minor key, you know,
mm-hmm.
is the dominant note of the psalm.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
The sort of lamentation and so forth. Mm-hmm. Bach would resolve it all into a major in the last verse at some point. But basically, up until 5, when he just seems to lose it there.
Well, the verses in 7 and 8 really aren't there. I mean, that's really the
anger and wrath are left out too, right?
That's
right. Because those are difficult verses. For mm-hmm. Christians, especially with, you know, the emphasis of the God of love and so forth, that kind of phraseology. And you see love coming up a lot here, that through our lives your love may shine, and unto all your love be shown, that in 4 and in 5. So this emphasis on God's love and no wrath or anger, right? So there's a sort of a different depiction of God in there. It's sort of a one-sided God. I mean, the love, God's love is evident in 90 also, you know, the eternal dwelling place and your steadfast love in the last part. But it's sort of a multi-dimensional God in the psalm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I spent several years singing in synagogues, and so often the texts were the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they just have the Old Testament. And I was so often struck because I was used to the way we dealt with those texts in the Christian church, that they weren't changed and dressed up, and they weren't made to be more positive than they were. Mm-hmm. It often occurred to me that the Christians were usually winners. Except for the very earliest ones, the Christians usually won, and the Jews usually lose.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in a wealthy suburb like Highland Park, Illinois, where the Jews seem to be winning, the Holocaust was just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still very conscious of the fact that life is like that, and that you can win and then suddenly lose very, very quickly. And so they didn't soften these things at all. That was a very valuable experience for me to take part in that kind of worship.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, you know, something that you said about the focus goes to God right away at the end instead of our lives, they're very transitory, you know, and so forth. But really, 13 through 17 are about, you know, give us joy, satisfy us, make, you know, give us as many good days as bad, and show your glorious power to the children, you know. So it's all about sort of our human lives, whereas in the psalm it really does switch to God's praise and glory and so forth. So there's a different aspect of the end. Mm-hmm. Any last observations? I like the minor tune in this. Let's go to O God, Our Help in Ages Past, 320.